Thank you for downloading from the BBC. For details of our complete range of podcasts and our terms of use, go to bbcworldservice.com/podcasts.
Hello, I'm Leslie Kerwin. Welcome to Business Daily. Coming up, new regulations for the derivatives that helped to cause the credit crisis.
The danger derives from the development of very complex instruments which people don't understand, and then they take risks which they themselves cannot handle.
And the Chinese investment pouring into Africa, does it really transform economies?
It doesn't sound like efficiency to me at all. In fact, the closer I look at the Chinese miracle in Africa, the stronger grows my suspicion that it is just a magic trick.
That's all in Business Daily from the BBC. Financial weapons of mass destruction. That's what the legendary investor Warren Buffett called derivatives. Well, these complex financial instruments now face a wave of new regulation. We all know that large numbers of dodgy US mortgages were transmuted by financial alchemy into trillions of dollars of high-priced derivatives until the housing market collapsed and the derivatives became toxic waste. They were so-called black boxes whose true contents were unknown, and the market was opaque. Investors just couldn't see how many of these derivatives were on the books of banks and other financial companies. The British economist Lord Eatwell, who is president of Queen's College Cambridge, is one of those pressing for reform. He painted a picture for me about the part derivatives played in the financial tsunami.
The origins of the financial crisis, which we are now going through, were, of course, in the collateralized debt obligation markets in the United States. Now, what that is all about is people making loans, ordinary loans, then bundling them up into a package of loans and selling that on as a package so that people would take the risk of further losses and so on if the loans were defaulted on. The other element that was at the centre of what went wrong was a thing called a credit default swap. Now, credit default swaps are rather like insurance contracts where somebody says, OK, you've made a loan. If the person defaults on the loan, I'll actually pay you the loan. I'll give you your money back. So I'm giving you a guarantee. And you pay me a fee, obviously, for providing that guarantee. Now, these two structures combined in a rather unfortunate way. Loans were made recklessly. They were made by people who said, well, I'm not going to take the risk. I'm just going to pay a fee. It'll get guaranteed. I don't have to worry about it. And so the mixture of these two financial instruments led to an extraordinary explosion of lending, and the composition of that lending and the risks associated with it were not understood by the people who were actually holding the risks because they were so complicated, and led to an incredibly complex structure which, when it started to fall over, fell over just as a series of dominoes. So these particular instruments, derivative instruments, at the centre of the financial crisis are obviously targeted as the key issues for reform.
How do you think they need to be reformed?
Well, the first thing is that the credit appraisal process failed. Loans were made in a reckless manner, which almost guaranteed that they would default. And this is the famous subprime loans in the United States. And also, some of the CDS contracts were used for people to carry risks which didn't go through proper risk appraisal processes. So the number one issue is that when a loan is made, the risk has to be properly appraised, and the person who is taking the risk has to understand it, has to understand what they're doing. And that means that a lot of very complex instruments will have to go, or if they don't go, they will have to have very high regulatory charges placed upon them so that people think very, very carefully before they enter into a highly complex loan arrangement.
Looking at the initial proposals that we've seen coming out of the US and Europe, how effective do you think they would be?
Well, I think that the proposals, both of the European and the US authorities, are moving certainly in the right direction. The first main proposal, for example, is that derivatives should be traded on markets with central counterparties. What that means is that there is some organisation, a central organisation, which is always willing to buy and is always willing to sell. It's a sort of market maker, a central counterparty, it's called. But this will only be possible if the instruments are relatively simple and relatively standardised. If they become very, very complicated, then the central counterparty will say, I can't evaluate that. I can't see what the risks are in there. So this requirement that credit default swaps and collateralized debt obligations be cleared with a central counterparty will in and of itself reduce the complexity of financial instruments and will be a major element in reducing that very dangerous complexity which was so damaging over the last couple of years.
How much resistance do you think there's going to be to reform?
Well, I think there's a significant amount of resistance to that reform, for example, because people argue that over-the-counter trades, as they're called, OTC trades, that is, trades between one firm and another firm without going through a central market, those are custom-made, they fit the needs of the individual firm, and forcing everybody into standardized contracts is going to lose that flexibility and that custom design character. I think that's entirely right. We are going to lose that, and that's probably a good thing. But insofar as the firms wish to maintain these over-the-counter, very complex, highly customized derivative trades, then they should pay a large regulatory penalty for doing that, because they are endangering the rest of us. They are actually imposing a risk on all of us that they themselves are not paying for. So there should be either high capital charges or very careful regulatory intervention in the design of the particular instruments.
How dangerous are derivatives?
Well, derivatives themselves are not necessarily dangerous. I mean, all a derivative is a financial instrument, the value of which is derived from something else. And derivative contracts have actually been enormously important in the development of economies. For example, the standard forward contracts in grain have been crucial to stabilising agricultural markets, and they're not particularly dangerous at all. The danger derives from the development of very complex instruments which people don't understand, and then they take risks which they themselves cannot handle.
Well, as Lord Eatwell was describing, new regulations have now been outlined in America and in Europe to try to make derivatives more transparent and safer. But what do those inside the financial industry make of the efforts to regulate them? Here are two different views. First, from the UK, from David Clark, a British banker who now chairs the Wholesale Market Brokers Association.
Financial products are absolutely essential to the smooth running of any economy. These products are used not only to take risk, but to reduce risk. Our particular issue, the market's issue with the authorities, is that there was a sort of misdiagnosis. They blamed over-the-counter markets, whereas the heart of the problem...
What are over-the-counter markets?
Over-the-counter markets are transactions that take place between anybody who wants to trade with one another. If I were to buy your car and you and I entered into a transaction, that is actually an over-the-counter contract. And most transactions in any economy are, by definition, over-the-counter.
And that's as opposed to having it traded on an exchange?
Correct. And our fear is that in a reaction against over-the-counter products, regulators will try and regulate them either out of existence or in such a way that it constrains them from anybody using them for their own purposes.
The argument is that if it's just a transaction between two parties, nobody knows about it, nobody counts it, nobody measures it, and you can't then estimate the amount of risk that's being taken on and the potential damage to the economy.
Well, it's not visible to the general public, but the people entering into the transactions certainly know what they're doing, certainly measure risk.
So what is your response to the arguments that, in fact, the over-the-counter agreements, effectively the private transactions, should be more highly regulated?
There are two key responses to that. One is that there's a very general agreement which has emerged in North America and Europe that what we would all try and do is to get as many over-the-counter products, not on exchanges, but into what we call clearing. The clearing process means that if I enter into an over-the-counter transaction, it doesn't become visible to the general public, but it goes through a central clearinghouse It is principally eliminating the risk that my counterparty might default between now and the time that the deal settles. And, of course, this is exactly what happened with Lehman's and AIG, and it's happened in the past in history, and no doubt it will happen again.
Do you think that ordinary people will ever regard derivatives as anything other than evil after what's happened?
The word derivative is like the word nuclear. It carries all sorts of connotations, but there are some very benign uses. And derivatives were essentially invented not to create risk, but to actually minimise risk. But we have got a big job to do in banking, to restore our reputation. And I think at that point, very complex markets will be left to the bankers and perhaps we might be trusted with them. And the whole aura that surrounds derivatives at the moment will change and people will see them as a benign necessity for innovation in the financial markets.
David Clark. Well, the Obama administration has supported the idea that derivatives should be sold wherever possible through a central clearinghouse. So how do America's big financial guns respond to that? I asked Robert Pickell, the chief executive of the Swaps and Derivatives Association.
It does reflect a sea change in the approach to regulation of derivatives, and for that reason, we are concerned about it. We're very eager to make sure that the policymakers understand the steps that are being taken in the industry, which we think really are sufficient and are done, in fact, very closely with regulators led by the New York Federal Reserve Bank. So that's a process that has been a very effective public-private partnership. I think what's in the proposals are tying people's hands in various ways. It's forcing certain transactions to go into a cleared or exchange-traded environment. And when you require things to be done in a certain way, you reduce flexibility in managing risk. And in fact, by reducing flexibility in managing risk, we actually think you have the potential for increasing risk. So we would very much be of the view that with the efforts that are currently underway within the industry, we are largely addressing any potential comments or concerns people may have had with the use of derivatives over the last several years.
So what you're really saying is that you're already addressing all the points that the administration is making on a voluntary basis. So why on earth bother with regulation?
That's right. I mean, I think there is a potential here. And I think...
What happens the next time we have a crisis? You know, maybe they have or they have not brought in this kind of change.
Well, I think in addition to the steps that we are taking as an industry, we would anticipate greater scrutiny from the supervisors. I think the major participants in this business are, in fact, very regulated. We're talking about banks and financial firms that are among the most regulated entities in the world. But it does require an effective regulator in there who is asking the hard questions and understands the product.
But forgive me, sir, isn't that the poacher blaming the gamekeeper?
Well, I think that we have demonstrated over the years, and I'm talking about our organization, putting in place an infrastructure for these products that has, in fact, worked effectively. Now, that it requires people to use them effectively and to understand the risks that they take on, and it does require the regulators to be actively involved in overseeing that business.
So what kind of behind-the-scenes lobbying are you doing right now?
Well, we've been meeting with the administration, various agencies that are involved in this. We've been talking to people up on Capitol Hill to help them understand the implications for the way in which companies manage risk. One thing these products do is it allows a company who's making cars or flying airplanes to manage the financial risks that they have so that they can focus on the business they're formed to do, to make cars or to fly airplanes, so that an airline doesn't need to worry as much about commodity price fluctuations if it can use these products to manage their exposure to jet fuel prices. The potential for the wider economy and for the global economy are quite significant here if there is too much regulation introduced into this business.
I was talking to Robert Pickell. You're listening to Business Daily from the BBC with Leslie Kerwin. One of the great stories of globalisation has been the steady spread of Chinese business interests across the face of Africa. China's trade flows with Africa recently overtook those of the United States. Some observers are concerned, though, about the political leverage that Beijing may now be exerting on the continent, which used to be dominated by former European colonial powers. Let's hear the views of our commentator, Bright Simons, who is the Director of Development Research at the Ghanaian think tank Imani.
What is the future for Africa on the world stage? U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton recently finished an 11-day seven-nation African tour. Coming on the back of President Obama's more momentous visit to Ghana, many were quick to point to a newfound enthusiasm in America to stake a clear claim to diplomatic sway in Africa.
in the face of growing competition from upstart powers. The Chinese connection in particular looms large. Just as the American pageantry was heading for its climax, word came that China-Africa trade has topped $107 billion, overtaking U.S.-Africa trade, which hovers around $105 billion. Moreover, the evidence suggests that China imports a comparatively wider range of raw materials and enjoys a heftier trade surplus with the continent. Observers have pointed to this development as one more piece of evidence that China's total dominance of Africa's economic relations is at hand. It is possible that this perception isn't the wild exaggeration it sounds. But there are certain aspects of the Sino-African relationship that gives one pause for thought on the topic. Every time I visit the bustling center of Ghana's capital city, Accra, the famous Kwame Nkrumah Circle, I am confronted by a chink in China's Africa conquest armor. Right next to the beating heart of Nkrumah Circle is an imposing building that has long been a fixture of the landscape but now bears a huge electronic sign saying China 99. You guessed right. It has been taken over by private Chinese investors. Those who gloss over the inefficiencies of China's state-driven investment spree in Africa like to point to the growing private sector involvement in the process and the ensuing greater efficiency. They like to brush aside the underperformance of Chinese investment in Zimbabwean mining concerns, most of them still tottering despite the influx of Chinese money. They refuse to give any weight to the quagmire that has been left for Guinea's bauxite industry after the Chinese pulled an investment deal there. And they dismiss any mention of growing signs of retreat from Chinese investment in the Congolese natural resource sector. Each time, they point to the success of Chinese private companies like Huawei and ZTE in grabbing major computer and networking contracts in Africa under the noses of the big players from the West. The argument is simple. The privatization of Chinese interests in Africa will wipe away the inefficiencies of the Chinese approach and ensure China's dominance in Africa as predicted. Well, China 99 reduces my appetite for this prophecy. Ever since the arrival of private Chinese money and management, every business in the complex seems to be in decline. The restaurant has collapsed. Judging by the lack of customers, the car and equipment vendor appears balanced on the brink. And more bizarrely, the internet cafe has the slowest speeds and most unreliable connections in Accra. It doesn't sound like efficiency to me at all. In fact, the closer I look at the Chinese miracle in Africa, the stronger grows my suspicion that it is just a magic trick. One with too many props that may one day crumble onto the sect before convincing anyone that the magician has perfected his trick. This is Bright Simmons for the BBC World Service.
Well, do you agree with Bright Simmons about China's investment in Africa? You can email us your views via our website. That's bbcworldservice.com, where you can also find our Business Daily podcast.
There's a BBC podcast for every area of business.
I'm Roger Hearing with the latest business news from the BBC.
From today's world business news to global trends with Peter Day.
So I've made a trip to the new China to see what impact credit crunch is having here.
And from the top of the morning.
Welcome to Wake Up to Money with Nikki Clark.
Hello, I'm Leslie Kerwin. Welcome to Business Daily.
To the bottom line.
Who makes money when boom turns to bust?
Download your choice of BBC business podcasts at bbc.co.uk/podcasts.